Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll be in BC, Alberta, Ontario, and Quebec. We'll first go to northern BC, where the NDP federal MP, Taylor Bacharach, wants Parliament to move faster on a red dress alert system.
The issue of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls is one that has had such a tragic history in our region and continues to affect so many families and communities.
The University of Northern British Columbia is all smiles as it lands $17 million in research funding.
A large amount of the funding actually goes to students as financial support. You know, they're hired as research assistants or given bursaries to work on research theses.
Alberta residents hit by flooding and forest fires will get $68 million.
As you can imagine, this was an incredibly challenging time for these folks, made even more difficult for those returning to damaged homes and businesses.
The Toronto Transit Commission goes green with plans to have its fleet hit zero emissions by 2040. And after a record-setting fire season, Quebec's provincial firefighting agency is recruiting and getting ready for the next.
Lightning came through June 1st and lit over 150 fires in one day. So many fires that we had to then prioritize which fires we were going to intervene on.
And Santa takes the helicopter over to Nanaimo Hospital and transit to other destinations in BC. He'll be with us.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company. We're first off to British Columbia, where the NDP federal MP, Taylor Bacharach, is launching a campaign to put pressure on the federal government to create a red dress alert system. The red dress alert is similar to the Amber Alert system. If an Indigenous woman has been reported missing, an alert will be sent via text right away. The idea for the red alert system was initiated last May by NDP MP for Winnipeg Centre, Gazan, who succeeded in gaining the support of Parliament for a Canada-wide red dress alert, according to Bacharach. But the system has not been implemented yet. That's why Bacharach has initiated his postcard campaign to put pressure on the federal government to get it done quickly. The campaign is especially relevant in northern BC, where Indigenous women and Two-Spirit people go missing, especially along Highway 16 between Prince Rupert and Prince George, known as the Highway of Tears. Sabrina Spencer is in Terrace, BC. She spoke with Bacharach about the Red Dress Alert proposal.
What we know from the Amber Alert system is that the first 24 hours are really critical. And the more people who are engaged in looking for someone who's been reported missing, the higher the chance of that person being found. Obviously, the issue of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls is one that has had such a tragic history in our region and continues to affect so many families and communities. And so this is a tangible, concrete step that we can take together as a country to ensure that when people's loved ones are reported missing, they're found as quickly as possible.
How long has it taken to get to this point, this idea come about?
This idea has really been championed by a woman named Leah Gazan, who's the Member of Parliament from Winnipeg. And about a year ago, she began her advocacy federally, pushing the federal government to put a red dress alert in place. In the last federal budget, we saw some language around accelerating consultations on a potential red dress alert. And now we're pushing the government to follow through and ensure that an alert system gets established as quickly as possible. Because this is such an important issue for our region, I'm launching a postcard campaign and targeting the public safety minister, Dominic LeBlanc, and encouraging people to sign postcards to the minister and coming together as a region to really speak as one and say that this is an important issue and this is something that we want the federal government to act on as quickly as possible.
Any idea why it's taking so long to come about?
I'm not sure why it's taking so long. I know that there are discussions underway. Obviously, we want to ensure that representatives from the families and Indigenous leadership are engaged in those consultations so that when the system is designed, it's designed in a way that is effective and robust and really serves Indigenous families. But we also need to see the system put in place quickly, because we know that this is a situation that affects families every single week across Canada. Every single month, there are people who are reported missing. And we don't want to see one more person in our region go missing and not be found. So hopefully, by communicating together as communities and as the Northwest region, we can put pressure on the federal government and let them know that this is something we expect them to do. This is something that's going to make things better, and it's something that needs to be put in place as quickly as possible.
So it's going to be Canada-wide. Are you just planning for BC first and then go from there? Or
the idea is certainly for a Canada-wide system. And we had the National Inquiry on Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls and Two-Spirit People. This relates to several of the calls for justice contained in their final report to do with the protocols around missing persons. So ideally, we want as many people out there searching in those very sad and unfortunate circumstances when people's loved ones are reported missing. And the hope is that when people go missing, they're found as quickly as possible. People are interested in signing one of these postcards and being part of the campaign, they can stop by my community offices in Prince Rupert Terrace and Smithers. They can also reach out to me on Facebook or send me an email, and I'd be happy to pop one in the mail to them. And they come with a beautiful little button that was designed by a woman named Jamie Davis, who does wonderful Indigenous art in the Northwest. And then people can wear the campaign on their shirt or on their jacket and share information about why we're doing this with people around them.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada.
We stay in British Columbia and turn to Prince George, where the University of Northern British Columbia, UNBC, received over $17 million in research and development grants during its most recent fiscal year. This thanks to the hard work of researchers and faculty. Research funding at UNBC spiked to nearly 17%, earning $17.7 million in research income in 2022. The grant funding touches social sciences and humanities, science and engineering, and health. Journalist Ian Craig met up with Dr. Paula Wood Adams. She was hired this September as Vice President of Research and Innovation at UNBC.
Where does the funding come from? Is this from a team of grant writers? Is it primarily coming from grants, or how does one arrive at this number?
So it's coming from grants, but we don't have a team of dedicated grant writers. So it's the researchers, the faculty members who are writing grants, and we provide support. So we give them feedback and help them lay out some of the things like the budget that maybe, you know, is a little bit complicated. But really it's the researchers who are doing the work, and that's what we're seeing here is the result of their efforts over the last couple of years.
Are you able to identify a confluence of a few factors that may have led to this spike in research activity?
Yeah, absolutely. So this, I would say, starts back when Jeff Payne was the Vice President of Research here. And you know him, of course, he's the president, right? And he started off with a big push to encourage researchers to apply for grants. And he provided some financial support to do that. So that they could, for example, pay a research assistant to help them put the grant together. And that started off this momentum. And then when Kathy Lewis took over, she was fantastic at continuing to encourage and support this kind of activity. And really, it's kind of growing momentum, you know. Once you've applied and received one grant, then it's much easier to do the next and so on. And that's what we're seeing right now. It's the fourth straight year that there's been an increase, and this is a direct result of my two predecessors' fantastic work in supporting the researchers.
That also highlights the kind of nature of research and granting that exists within academia and so many other organizations, where sure, the grant funding is available, it's out there, but where does the time and energy and resources come from for individuals to put it in? Most of the time, this is a volunteer endeavor done in between tasks, child rearing, work, the research itself, and holidays, etc., right? And it sounds like the extra support has really paid off.
So the hardest one is starting off or restarting. And so providing kind of a boost and extra support for researchers to, you know, to apply to new places or think of bigger projects that they want to work on, I think that was really, really important. And, you know, one of the big impacts actually of having these grants at the university is that, as well as making it possible to buy supplies for the lab or to go on field trips, a large amount of the funding actually goes to students as financial support. And, you know, they're hired as research assistants or given bursaries to work on research theses. And that really complements the training that and education that they're getting in classrooms or in, you know, in their labs. So it has kind of this full circle benefit for the entire institution and not just the researcher.
And of the projects, it's overwhelming and it's probably difficult for you to pick any, but what has passed across your desk? What did you take notice of as a project to look forward to?
So there's many exciting things going on here. I think I'll talk about a couple of things that I personally find very interesting. The first one is the work that's being done at CTAN, which is the Center for Technology.
Center for Technology Adoption for Aging in the North.
It's technology for older adults and, you know, helping them to be able to stay in their home and live more comfortable lives for a longer period of time. And we are especially good at this area of research. And the director, the academic director of that center is Shannon Freeman. She's an associate professor in the Faculty of Nursing or the School of Nursing. And she's created CTAN really along with her collaborator, Richard McAloney. And now UNBC is one of four national innovation centers where technologies can be tested and evaluated for their suitability for being applied in the homes of older adults or being used in long-term care facilities or other retirement-type homes. So it's really incredible what they're doing. They're making things possible right here in northern BC, and they're doing it in collaboration with the local healthcare authority, Northern Health. So it's really fantastic, and really they're one of four national centers. They're just having an amazing impact. So that's one area of research that I find really interesting. And then the other area is what's being done over at the Quesnel River Research Center. And this is kind of a research station that's located a few hours by drive from Prince George past Quesnel. And it's a center that used to be run by the provincial government under natural resources. And we took it over years and years ago. And we have researchers there who are doing really important work looking at the effects of industry on pollution levels and other kind of ecological markers in the rivers and connected lakes in the region.
It's really encouraging to hear about projects that are getting such active community engagement, and it's refreshing to hear that they're also receiving funding to continue, which it doesn't always happen, right?
Well, exactly.
An exciting development on UMBC campus. Also relevant, a project looking at aging, and it sounds like aging in place as well. It's occurring in our community.
You know, there's so many. Those were just two examples that I find really appealing, but there's so many other things going on in many different areas. And really what has impressed me the most since I came and what actually brought me here is the ingenuity and the can-do attitude and the brilliance of the researchers that we have. We're small, but the people that we have are outstanding, and that's really what brought me here, and it's what produced this result as well that we've been discussing. And yeah, I think UNBC is a gem, and we're really lucky to have this institution.
Speaking with us is Dr. Paula Wood Adams. That is UMBC's Vice President of Research and Innovation, presiding over $17.7 million in research income over the fiscal year of 2022. The fourth straight year UMBC's total has increased. This is Ian Gray.
Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints.
We continue east to Toronto, Ontario, where the Toronto Transit Commission's Green Fleet Plan seems to be on track to produce zero emissions by their target date of 2040. More on this with Owen Thompson in Toronto, Ontario.
At a TTC board meeting on December 7th, Ben Case, Executive Director of Innovation and Sustainability at the TTC, presented that the TTC is on track to meet their goal. For the TTC to completely convert their fleet to electric, Case says they need 2,875 electric buses by 2040. Currently, they have received funding for 400 electric buses, with 290 of those coming in 2025. These purchases have the TTC on track to meet their goal of 20% zero emissions vehicles by 2025. Case says,
"We need to procure an average of 155 per year. That's just to maintain current service levels. With additional buses required to grow capacity and meet projected demand, the TTC will need yet unsecured funding for the additional 60 buses required in 2025 and all of the buses you see here on the screen thereafter. Of the 2,875 buses required by 2040, only 250 of those are for growth."
The TTC expects the last diesel bus to be phased out by 2032. In the TTC board meeting, Case says they expect to completely move to electric buses by 2037.
"Through the Green Bus Program, we took delivery of our last fully diesel bus in July of 2018, and in that same month introduced the first hybrid electric bus. In February of 2022, we awarded contracts for 336 hybrids planned for delivery in 2023 and 2024. As of November 30th, 214 of those 336 had been delivered and 142 in service."
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Follow us on X at CanadaLJI.
And a heads up, if you're fluent in Spanish, our journalist Yvette Hernandez in Toronto, Ontario, has been working on two great stories this week. And as some of you might know, Toronto celebrated for the first time since 2019 the prizes for Access, Equity and Human Rights, Premios Acceso, Equidad y Derechos Humanos. The Latin American community wanted to mark December 7, the International Day for Human Rights, by recognizing the work of different people and organizations that contribute to strengthening equity, reconciliation, and justice in Toronto. Yvette Hernandez also had a chat with a Latin American Canadian documentary director, Alejandro Miguel Pereira, who received a 2023 Recognition Award at the Indie Fest Film Awards. His documentary, We're Still Here, We're Here, won in the documentary short film and Latin Hispanic categories at this renowned American film festival.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sassang. Log in to CanadaInfo.ca to get all our stories.
And we hop over to the province next door. During Alberta's 2023 wildfire season, Whitecourt, Edson, and other communities in Yellowhead County and Woodlands County were surprised by flooding on top of ongoing fires in the region. The flooding in the area was a combination of spring runoff from the mountains and heavy rainfall, according to the provincial government. Well, there's relief on the way. The Alberta government just announced that $68 million will be made available to the residents of the affected communities to help them rebuild homes and businesses starting December 7th. Details with Ryan Hunt in Alberta.
The Alberta government is giving support to communities that were affected by flooding back in June. Mike Ellis, the Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Services, spoke at a press conference and explained what happened back in the spring.
Following the relentless fury of the wildfires that swept through the province, leaving devastation in their wake, nature dealt another blow in June with a significant flooding in Edson and Whitecourt and Yellowhead County and Woodlands County. Still grappling with the disruption of wildfire evacuations, many residents in these communities found themselves having to flee again to escape the flooding. As you can imagine, this was an incredibly challenging time for these folks, made even more difficult for those returning to damaged homes and businesses. We recognize that recovering from this kind of disaster is a challenging task, which is why the Alberta government is stepping up to help.
The government is making $68 million available through the Disaster Recovery Program for residents and business owners to utilize to help build their communities back up. Martin Long, the MLA for West Yellowhead, explains how important this program is for his constituency.
Residents in West Yellowhead have endured a lot this past year, from forest fires to heavy flooding. We've experienced adversity unlike anything I've seen in my time living there. It's been a challenging time for the communities in my riding, and I want to take a moment to acknowledge the resilience and the strength my constituents have shown in the face of these challenges. While the past summer has made life immeasurably harder for too many of my constituents, I'm proud to share that the government of Alberta is stepping up to the plate to help relieve some of the financial burdens and make life a little easier for those affected by the floods.
Tom Pickard, the mayor of Whitecourt, explains some of the things his community has endured and how helpful this money will be.
This past summer, Whitecourt has had a very difficult time. We had significant fire issues early in the year, and then in mid-June, the McLeod River Basin and the Athabasca River Basins received the most rain we've seen in many, many years. Our community and our region suffered significant damage, but for Whitecourt, primarily the river spurs, the river erosion areas, and vital infrastructure around abutments and culverts. These all are significant, and we really, really appreciate the provincial government assisting us in making this better for our community and working on fixing these areas and our entire region.
I'm Ryan Hunt.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
And we all remember the summer of 2023, which saw many parts of the country hit by a record-setting fire season. Smog alerts and evacuations were frequent in BC, Alberta, Quebec, and even in the Northwest Territories. In Quebec, after a quiet spring, more forest fires burned this season than in the last 20 years combined. At one time, lightning storms ignited more than 150 fires at the same time. Well, Quebec's Forest Fire Protection Society is currently in recruiting mode after the most destructive summer of wildfires on record. It's now getting ready for the next season and will need to hire as much as 55 new firefighters over the next few months. Caleb Nickerson in Pontiac, Quebec, is here with Mélanie Morin, a communications officer in Sopfeu's Western Region, who remembers very well all that went on over the past few months.
We had a very quiet spring. We even were able to send out firefighters to Alberta to help out with their beginning of the season. We remember that lots of areas dealt with flooding back in March and April. And then May started to dry out. We got busy by the end of May, and then lightning came through June 1st. And lit almost 200, between over 150 fires in one day. That really was the beginning of this very, very busy season. Dry lightning came through, lit quite a few fires, so many fires that we had to then prioritize which fires we were going to intervene on. Again, priority one was human life. Priority two was critical infrastructure. And then that just kind of painted the picture for the rest of the summer, particularly in the western portion of the province and northwestern portion of the province towards the Val-d'Or area and then up into the James Bay, received very, very little rain, more lightning, and then the fires just kept getting new fires and then becoming bigger. So we really were into wildfires into September in that area.
I understand you also got a bunch of help from outside agencies, agencies from other countries, that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about the scale, how many forest firefighters were brought in, and sort of compared to the overall size of the SOPFA itself?
So we were working with a daily about 1,500, 1,600 firefighters, boots on the ground, and that was with rotations. We are used to having help from across Canada. This summer we had the limited help that we could have from across Canada because many other provinces were dealing with similar seasons. Then we had quite a bit of help, close to 1,000 firefighters that came from the U.S. And then after that, we had international firefighters, 140 from South Korea, 300 from France, 140 from Portugal, 100 from Spain, and then quite a few armed forces that were also here to help us put out the wildfires.
Melanie, I want to thank you for your time. Thanks for speaking with us about this.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we close our show today to report that Santa Claus has been quite busy in the past few days and no doubt will be for those ahead as well. Santa Claus, who was spotted flying over Nanaimo early last Tuesday morning, he traded his sleigh for a chance to fly in an air ambulance helicopter. He landed at Nanaimo Regional General Hospital. Santa wanted to go there to visit sick children in the hospital's pediatric unit, as well as five other hospitals on Vancouver Island and the Lower Mainland. Santa has been flying with BC's Emergency Health Services and Helijet for 19 years now, delivering toys to children during the holidays. Here is Santa himself speaking with Mick Sweetman in Nanaimo, BC.
I'm here today to spread a little bit of cheer along with Helijet, the BC Emergency Health Services, and we can thank Helijet big time for their 19 years of providing this service to bring Santa Claus instead of the reindeer to a place like Nanaimo, Victoria, Abbotsford, Surrey, Royal Columbian and New Westminster, and BC Children's Hospital, of course, which is our next stop.
One of Santa's helpers this year was Brian Thorburn, an infant transport team critical care paramedic.
Our role is to support Santa and spreading cheer to the children that can't be at home, maybe not at home by Christmas, but certainly not at home right now. And we want them to feel that they've not been forgotten, that Santa's still thinking about them and loves them, and that he's bringing a little bit of something for them today to look at and remember, you know, this is Christmas, even though they're in the hospital.
As Santa walked the hospital hallways, greeting both young and old, sounds of Christmas music was heard from the nursing station. One of the children that saw Santa was Aura Von Poser, who was just 3 months old. Her mother, Erin Sarby Green, held her as she met Santa, which was a welcome surprise after returning to the hospital.
Aura was born premature, so she was here in the NICU for 4 weeks, and then we've been home for a while now. And then she's just been having some difficulties with choking, so we're coming in to just check it out with the pediatrician and make sure everything's A-okay. But yeah, Santa was an unexpected surprise.
Wearing an elf hat with jingle bells, child life specialist Sandra Hirota says the kids, families, and staff always love Santa's annual visit to the hospital.
Having Santa come by Helijet is the highlight of our year. We're always like pediatric paparazzi and always with our camera and videos when he steps off Helijet and with smiles and his elf coming in through Emerge as well as onto the pediatric unit. Brings lots of smiles both to patients and families as well as to the staff. Makes a huge difference. We had a little girl here that was having a hard time before Santa came, and she did amazing and just like rallied and was able to get interviewed by Santa and mom too. So it just shows that Santa is always spreading his holiday cheer and joy.
And good luck, Santa. That's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists, Mick Sweetman, Caleb Nickerson, Ryan Hunt, Ian Craig, Owen Thompson, and Sabrina Spencer. Our national editors are Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the precious help of your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne, and a teaser for next week to let you know that many changes are coming, all very positive, and will kind of mutate a bit and shed our old skin. So stay tuned. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
/vote.ca.